The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
Greetings, listeners. This is Wendy Byrne bringing you the Corvallis Civics Cafe, covering the first full week of March 2025. Thanks for tuning in to KORC's News, Music, and Civics show. The show airs on Sundays from 1 p.m. to 2 p.m. and repeats on Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m. And Civics Cafe can also be heard on Tuesday mornings at 10 a.m. following the many moods of Ben Vaughn. Last week, we enjoyed a box of donuts while catching up on 2 weeks of local civics. But this week, we can sit down for a more traditional dishing of details of city governance and civic happenings. So pull up a chair and have a look at today's menu. The main course is a review of the City Council's March 3rd business meeting, and the dessert is a triple-layer cake of items from their March 6th work session. The post-meal coffee will be what's coming up next for local civics. Let's get to it. On Monday night, March 3rd, at the City Council business meeting, the Council worked its way through a full agenda for another long-lasting meeting that came in at 3 hours and 40 minutes. The first hefty topic was a hearing on the appeal brought to the council by the developer who has built workforce housing on Northwest 23rd Street for the employees of the Boys and Girls Club. The long story short is that while the developer originally agreed to the condition to upgrade part of the sewer line from a 4-inch pipe to a 6-inch pipe to meet city code, somewhere during the construction, they decided to ask for a variance to allow for the 4-inch pipe to remain. They balked at the added cost to change the size of the pipe and argued that the city code was arbitrary and capricious. The reading material for the case does make some good points about ways that city code might be responsible for pushing up the cost of development. But to my ear and my eyes, our city code is anything but arbitrary and capricious on this point. In the end, the City Council voted unanimously to deny the appeal and to uphold the requirement that there must be a 6-inch-sized sewer lateral in the right-of-way to connect the outflow of the 4 units of housing on the lot to the city sewer. It was nice to see the city's team of attorneys working in tandem. One of the team members represented the City Council, while the other was there to represent the Department of Public Works. During the Council's deliberations, Ward 8's Carolyn Mayers made a good point when she said, "I want to be very clear that as much as the Boys and Girls Club needs housing, the delay has not been caused by the city. It was caused by decisions of the developer not to follow standards that he agreed to." She went on to highlight that the expenses incurred by the delay were also not on the shoulders of the city, as it would have been far less expensive to do the required work at the beginning of the project than it will be to open up the street and complete the work now. Of course, you can watch the video for yourself at the City Archives or at vimeo.com/City of Corvallis. As of Saturday morning, March 8th, Ella Hutcherson reported in the Gazette Times that the developers have elected not to appeal the case and will move forward with replacing the sewer line and finishing their project. In other City Council work that night, there was a public hearing about land development code text amendments regarding a code audit on residential clear and objective standards, with a presentation from staff on updates to our land development code. Is there irony that they discussed code changes in an effort to promote more housing right after the earlier hearing where a local developer accused the city of creating hurdles to development? You'd have to read all of the material for yourself to decide. In this case, I'm landing on the side of the city, which does seem to be working hard to create change in our code and development processes to facilitate development of housing. Personally, I do believe that certain standards should be met and feel the city is trying to strike a balance. Don't agree? Let me know. Want to talk about it? Reach me via email at wendy@korcfm.com. As frequently happens at our City Council meetings, some of the most interesting moments happen toward the end, during the section titled Mayor, Councilor, and City Manager Reports. On Monday, March 3rd, those reports started approximately 2 hours and 30 minutes into the meeting. During his comments, the mayor reiterated his strong support for the LGBTQIA community in Corvallis, which I appreciate, including his intention to see the Pride flag continue to fly at our courthouse each June during Pride Month. Later in his comments, he spoke about his town hall and defended his speech and the answers he gave to the questions presented to him. The spicy part of this meeting came at the 3-hour mark, when Councillor Ellis spoke, as she put it, to address the limitation to the documents that were posted on the city website. Councillor Ellis's comments set off responses from the mayor, from Ward 9's Tony Cadena, from Ward 7's Paul Schaefer, as well as others. Kadena's comments included colorful language not usually heard at our council chambers. Perhaps some of you listeners read the article on this in the digital edition of the Gazette Times from Ella Hutcherson on March 6th. It was titled, "Corvallis Counselor Seeks Answers Following Her Lawsuit, Gets Cussing in Response." It's good journalism and makes me proud to support her writing by being a subscriber to the Gazette Times. The conversation was ultimately left unfinished by request of Ward 2's Bria Lewis, but there does seem to be a division on the council as to how, or if, they will continue to work on being transparent about the details of the Ellis versus City of Corvallis case now that we are on this side of it. Tony Kadena appears to think that the community at large does not care. Paul Schaefer disagrees. What do you think? Let your council person know if you have unanswered questions. I sure do. If you're not sure how to connect to your city council representative, one easy way is to go to corvallisoregon.gov, then find the tab in the upper right of the webpage that says Government. Hover on that tab and you will see a column titled Mayor and Council. You can then click on Share Public Input, and it will take you to a page that allows you to make comments on the record to the mayor and council. As with many things internet-related, there are several other ways to find out the email address for your city council representative, and I encourage you to spend time on the city website to familiarize yourself with the useful information that is there. Did you know that on the Thursdays that follow their formal Monday business meetings, the council has a more casual meeting called a work session? These sessions normally include presentations from staff or advisory boards, and the information shared at these sessions informs the decisions the council makes at future business meetings, so they matter. On Thursday, March 6th, there were three topics discussed. Number one, review of various models for managing franchise utilities. Granted, this might seem a little wonky, but bear with me. Utility providers, such as gas, electric, and internet service, use the public right-of-way to get their services to us. The city makes money from this relationship. There is an older method for managing this, called a franchise agreement. There is a newer method, called a licensing ordinance. Research done right here at Oregon State University has outlined the pros and cons of the two methods and identified that cities that have shifted from the franchise agreement to the licensing ordinance model find that the benefits outweigh the negatives. It turns out that cities that use licensing ordinances generate more funds and use less staff time to manage the utilities. For the sake of brevity, I've oversimplified that explanation, but there is more information in the minutes of the meeting, and you can find it for yourself if this piques your appetite. My worry? The staff report and presentation the council heard minimized the benefits of changing to the licensing ordinance model, and I'm not sensing willingness to dig deeper, nor did staff communicate directly with the Oregon State University professor who did the research I've mentioned. Ward 9's Tony Kadena tried to sum it up by saying that both methods were, quote, theoretically the same, end quote. But the research demonstrates the opposite. Fortunately, the president of the city council, Paul Schaefer, put a pin in the discussion to continue it at a later date and moved on with the agenda. Item number two. In a process that started in 2019, just after the most recent update of the city's transportation system plan, our Department of Public Works began developing changes to the method of collecting charges from developers to pay for increased demands on the transportation system associated with that development. These are called transportation system development charges. The work was disrupted by COVID, then delayed further when there was a transition to a new director of public works. But it's back on track now, and the new city council had an update on Thursday, March 6th. System development charges are fees that are collected from developers to cover the costs of the increased use of the existing systems and to support the new infrastructure that can come from growth. New households and employees will add pedestrian, auto, bike, and transit trips to the existing transportation system. Transportation system development charges are meant to help pay for that, because some existing facilities can accommodate additional trips, and others cannot. The transportation system plan identifies improvements needed to expand capacity across all modes to accommodate the projected growth in trips. The past process of essentially charging a one-size-fits-all fee for system development charges has been shown to disproportionately impact smaller home construction. When jurisdictions move to scaling their system development charges, the reductions on the low end can make a difference. Corvallis is considering such changes. Any changes made to the current system development charges will be voted on by the City Council, and to do so, there is a specific process to follow. This includes that they maintain a list of interested parties, that they establish a public engagement for this process, that they hold a public hearing with a 90-day notice and a 60-day review of the methodology. In the end, all of this discussion will come to a formal business meeting so that the Council can hold the hearing and vote on their decision. Item number 3. Finally, the City Council heard an overview of their new strategic plan. In 2024, the members of the prior City Council changed one of their guiding documents. At that point, it was called the Strategic Operational Plan. The goal was to remove the operations from the document. City staff handles operations. City Council handles the policy and the vision, thus the strategy. In December of 2024, the Council adopted their new strategic plan. At this work session, on March 6th, staff reviewed that process and the new document, and the members of this City Council had a little time to discuss what is now titled the 2025 to 2029 Strategic Plan. Ward 3's Jim Moorfield pushed back on the content of the plan, saying he feels there are missing elements. But time was short at the end of the work session, and they agreed to continue the discussion at a later date. And the Civics Cafe is nearing the end of the meal for today. Coming up next week, the city is gearing up for budget season. On Tuesday, March 11th, starting at 6 p.m., in Council Chambers at the downtown fire station at 400 Northwest Harrison Boulevard, there will be a City Budget Commission orientation. People who are interested in following the money are encouraged to attend. This meeting will take place in person and can be viewed online. To register, go to CorvallisOregon.gov. On Wednesday, March 12th, also taking place at the downtown fire station on the second floor in the Council Chambers, there will be a joint meeting of the Corvallis City Council and the Benton County Board of Commissioners. They will be having a land use hearing. Speaking of the Benton County Board of Commissioners, do you know how to pay attention to Benton County civics? Tune in next week and I'll bring some of that to the table. Thanks for listening to this week's Corvallis Civics Cafe. If you have any questions or comments on the information I presented, please reach out to me via email at wendy@korcfm.com. And if you have any input for KORC's news, music, and civics, you can contact us via email at news@korcfm.com.
You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics. You can hear this program Sundays from 1 to 2 p.m. It repeats Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m. And we keep an archive at our website, korcfm.com. This is Dan Krall. I'm walking alongside Highway 34 between Alce and Corvallis. I record this on a Monday. I had an appointment out here, and an emergency came up with the person I was going to interview, and I decided to kill a little time. I would walk along the roadside picking up trash, because I've done that in the past. A neighbor of mine, Bob Ozetrich, died a few years ago doing what I consider this heroic act, picking up trash on the side of the road. Some drunkard ran into him and then drove off. They caught him. But that gave me pause for a time as far as my activity with cleaning up trash on the road. But I just picked what was seriously like not even a quarter mile of road, and I was able to fill up two trash bags. Two whole trash bags. There's just trash all over this highway. And I've done some volunteer cleanup efforts closer to Mary's Peak. And, yeah, I mean, it's not a part of any organized effort. And I'm going to put the trash in with the rest of the trash I get rid of. Won't cost me anything extra. But if you are able, if you have a pickup truck or other means of transporting trash bags, maybe one of those little pickup devices that you can squeeze trash and just put into a bucket or bag. In my case, I'm wearing a rubber glove, and I had a trash bag in my truck. This is important. Maybe it's not your job, but as we've seen just recently, a lot of federal agencies have received giant illegal cuts. The dust has not settled. In the meantime, we, the people, are going to really have to pick up the slack. We can certainly realize and despair over how we just can't have nice things while the billionaires take it all. And meanwhile, there is work that can be done. Something as simple as picking up trash on the side of the road. It needs to be done. This is, as I stand here in the Coast Range, with Westwood Community Church in view, right on this stretch of Highway 34, and Decker Road is off about a half mile away to the west. And this is such a beautiful place. As I look around, I don't see how anyone could take this for granted, or much less throw litter out the window. But I want to be that counterbalance that I know is needed, even for this little stretch of highway. And I'm not here to brag on myself. I'm here to encourage you to take up some kind of volunteer effort, such as picking up trash. That is one with a lot of need. I have found all sorts of microplastics, some zip ties, hunks of metal, a number of deposits, at least a dollar or two worth of deposits, old cigarette packages. So there may not be a lot of financial reward, but I feel like I've done my good deed for the day, and I just wanted to share it with you in the listening audience. My interview got canceled kind of last minute here out in the Coast Range, but perhaps we will make that work and either put it on later in the hour or on future episodes of KORC News, Music, and Civics. Until then, this is Dan Krall, picking up trash on the side of Highway 34, just outside Philomath.
This is Wendy Byrne for KORC's News, Music, and Civics with a list of City of Corvallis meetings for the week of Monday, March 10th to Sunday, March 16th. Materials for all city meetings, including the agenda for each meeting and the published information for each meeting, can be found on the city's website at corvallisoregon.gov. On Monday, March 10th, the Safe Streets and Roads for All Task Force meeting will be held from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room. The meeting will take place live and virtually and is open to the public. Register online to attend virtually or come in person to the Madison Avenue Meeting Room located at 500 Southwest Madison Avenue in the heart of downtown Corvallis. On Tuesday, March 11th, the City of Corvallis Budget Commission will hold its orientation meeting for the beginning of the upcoming budget cycle. This orientation session will be held in person and virtually. See the city website for the published agenda and for work session details and participation instructions. This meeting will take place in Council Chambers, located on the second floor of the downtown Corvallis Fire Station at 400 Northwest Harrison Boulevard. Also on Tuesday, March 11th, there will be a meeting of the Historic Resources Commission starting at 6:30 p.m. The public may observe the meeting live at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room at 500 Southwest Madison Avenue, or via the internet by registering from a link on the city webpage. To register, go to corvallisoregon.gov. On Wednesday, March 12th, attend Coffee with Your Economic Development Office at 10 a.m. The Corvallis-Benton County Economic Development Office invites you to their monthly outreach event series. Come talk about economic development and business support with the broader Corvallis community. Coffee with Your Economic Development Office is a monthly event held at a different cafe in Corvallis each month. The March meeting is from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. at Sam's Station, located at 1210 Northwest 29th Street in Corvallis. Wednesday, March 12th at 4 p.m., there will be a joint meeting of the Corvallis City Council and the Benton County Board of Commissioners. Everyone is welcome and encouraged to attend City Council meetings. This joint meeting will be held in person and virtually. See the published agenda for work session details and participation instructions at corvallisoregon.gov. This meeting will be held at the Corvallis City Council Chambers, located on the second floor of the downtown fire station at 400 Northwest Harrison Boulevard. Also on Wednesday, March 12th at 6 p.m., there will be a virtual-only information session to familiarize community members with the Corvallis Green Grants and Empowerment Grants. These two grant programs are administered by the City of Corvallis. Session topics will include grant program timelines, grant program criteria, tips for filling out the application, and a Q&A session. To attend, register online from the city's website, corvallisoregon.gov. This live session will be recorded and posted to the City of Corvallis website for future viewing. On Thursday, March 13th, at 4 p.m., there will be a meeting of the City Legislative Committee. This meeting will be online only. The public may sign up to watch the meeting live by visiting corvallisoregon.gov. On Saturday, March 15th, at 10 a.m., Ward 6 Councilor Allison Bowden will host Government Comment Corner at the Corvallis-Benton County Public Library from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. Please stop by to say hello and ask your questions about local government. This is an in-person only event. The library is located at 645 Northwest Monroe Avenue in Corvallis. More information about each event, including materials for all city meetings and the agenda for each meeting, can be found at the city's website at corvallisoregon.gov. This is Wendy Byrne for KORC's News, Music, and Civics.
The following is an article written in 2012 for the Willamette Heritage Center's biannual publication, Willamette Valley Voices, and was authored by local historians Tony Rush and Jim Creighton. The original article, with citations and footnotes, along with tons of engaging content and resources about Willamette Valley history, is available at willametteheritage.org/publications. Dancing Its Way Into Your Heart, The Cottonwoods Ballroom from 1930 to 1960 by Tony Rush and Jim Creighton. While there are many places in the mid-Willamette Valley that have wonderful memories behind them, there is one particular location that encompasses the memories of those from the Albany-Lebanon area, the Cottonwoods Ballroom. Imagine a place where one could go to dance and hear music on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday nights and every other night of the week. In this place, you could not only go with a group of guys or girls for a big night out on the town, you could also take a family because there was no age limit. One could relax and listen to the house bands play original music local to the region. On other nights, one could hear the tunes of some of America's best-known bands, including Johnny Cash, Fats Domino. The Cottonwoods Ballroom, once located on Highway 20 between Lebanon and Albany, was a place where people could experience these moments. The dance hall was more to the people of the region than just another building. It was a place where they could enjoy themselves, socialize with friends, experience great entertainment, and make lifelong memories. Throughout the dance hall's existence, the types of bands that played there changed. Once a place where big band and country music was popular in the 1940s, the dance hall followed the development of rock and roll into the 1950s. Cottonwoods Ballroom holds some of the fondest memories for those in the region. Cottonwoods Ballroom was built by Gladys and Harry Wiley around 1930. The dance floor itself was about 7,500 feet, one of the largest in the state. Advertisements from this time refer to the Sanyam Cottonwoods Dance Pavilion as a place where people can enjoy both old-time Western music and modern popular music. Cottonwoods not only included major performers, but also local bands. The Cottonwood Cubs, and the Willamette Valley Boys, who provided regular entertainment for the weekly dances. Prices for dances were 50 cents for gents and 10 cents for the ladies. According to Jim Creighton, a historian, the 1930s were some of the most intriguing to his studies. Creighton's research includes fascinating interviews, as well as articles and advertisements from the Albany Democrat Herald and the Lebanon Express. Creighton discovered that during the 1930s, many black performers played at the Cottonwoods. He's heard rumors from locals that black performers were not allowed to stay in the hotels of the area and had to travel to Portland to find lodging. Perhaps this was the Golden West Hotel, the only hotel in Portland during the early 30s that would allow black people to stay. However, rumors also tell of how an anonymous farmer from the region allowed some of the performers to stay overnight in his barn, sleeping on the hay, instead of making the long trek to Portland on Highway 99 before the days of Interstate 5. During the 1930s, there was to be no mingling or dancing between races because segregation was still in effect throughout Oregon. According to the Oregon State Bar, business owners were allowed to discriminate by race in Oregon until 1953. That year was a turning point in Oregon legislation concerning race relations. Most of the quote-unquote colored bands were said to have traveled in old buses. Band members would come off their bus, perform at the Cottonwoods, go straight back to the bus, and travel to their next performance. A unique example of these bands of the time was the Harlem Playgirls, an all-girl African-American band consisting of 12 performers, who appeared at the Cottonwoods on July 28, 1935. Advertisements in the Lebanon Express described them as, quote, the world's greatest colored girls dance band. The Harlem Playgirls were a swing band in the 1930s and 1940s who played all across the United States. If you're just tuning in, we're learning about the Cottonwoods Dance Hall, a music venue which existed just outside of Lebanon, Oregon, from the 1930s to the 1960s, and hosted an ethnically diverse array of musicians during that time period, from jazz and country to early rock and roll. According to Joseph Whitecotton, the ladies of jazz and swing were not well known through the time period. This band, along with other all-colored groups such as the Eli Rice Orchestra, Gene Coy's 11 Black Aces, and the St. Louis Black and Tans, brought their musical skills and entertainment to the region. Creighton believes that perhaps many of these bands were left over from the time of vaudeville. These bands were brought to the Cottonwoods by Cole McElroy, a band leader from the 1920s who owned the Spanish Ballroom in Portland. At the time, McElroy's was the only dance hall in Portland that catered to African Americans. Research indicates that McElroy also put on these shows at the Willamette Park Ballroom in Eugene. Because the ballroom in Eugene and the correspondence between the halls, this can be seen as a part of the large circuit that these groups followed. These traveling bands may have provided the roots of jazz and blues in Oregon. Cottonwoods provided a place for them to perform music when many other dance halls in Oregon denied showing their performances. It was not until after World War II that African Americans settled in Portland and created a lively jazz culture, sometimes referred to as Jump Town. The development changed how black performers were interpreted through the following years. A big change came to the Cottonwoods in 1940 with the divorce of Harry and Gladys Wiley, the owners of the dance hall. As co-owners, they had picked the bands that would play at the Cottonwoods together. Following their divorce, this changed. Harry moved to Lebanon, opened the Knothole Cafe, and became involved in local politics. Following the divorce, Gladys maintained ownership and operation of the dance hall and the Cottonwoods Tavern across the street until her death in 1966. The World War II era also brought changes to the dance hall. Most men were sent off to serve in the war effort, and the Cottonwoods adapted by featuring bands such as Hazel Fisher and her all-girl band, who performed regularly in 1943 and 1944. Hazel and her band became a huge draw for soldiers from the nearby Camp Adair, who flocked to Cottonwoods throughout the war. During the war, the prices for visiting Cottonwoods increased to 75 cents for men and 50 cents for ladies. The dance hall changed from the 1930s to the 40s and now featured new bands to cater to its changing clientele. One amusing story from the war years featured a man who drove a Ford Model A to Camp Adair offering rides to the Cottonwoods. Soldiers would pitch in a nickel each and then cram as many of them into the Model A as possible. The car would go all the way to Cottonwoods, about 20 miles, with soldiers crammed inside, standing on the running boards and draped over the fenders. At Cottonwoods, another group would be ready to return to the base, and the procedure was repeated as the car drove back and forth all weekend. Another interviewed source, who wished to remain anonymous, told stories of how when he was 14 years old, his father asked him to pick him up at Cottonwoods because he'd be too intoxicated to drive home. He remembers dropping his father off at the tavern across from the Cottonwoods a few hours before the concerts would begin. Following the performances, he would drive back to pick up his father in their old Ford, and many of his buddies would jump aboard as well, fearful of their wives seeing them in such a condition. While alcohol was not served in the dance hall, many people stashed a bottle in their car and made trips out to the parking lot during the show to, quote, get some air and enjoy a drink. Another option was to simply walk across the street to the tavern. After World War II, America rejoiced with the music from the big band era. Cottonwoods brought them all to the Mid-Valley with performers like Louis Armstrong, Bob Crosby, Count Basie, the Nat King Cole Trio, Harry James, Gene Krupa, Woody Herman, and Duke Ellington, as well as more local bands such as Al Benning and his orchestra from Salem, who provided entertainment on the weekends. Many of the big-name bands played at Cottonwoods during the week as they traveled between shows in bigger cities like Portland and Eugene for their weekend shows. These singers would have provided quite the entertainment for the people of the Albany-Lebanon area. Nat King Cole, who's known for his career as a pop vocalist, got his start in a smaller, less well-known band, the King Cole Trio. Early shows at the Cottonwoods brought in new music to the region, provide some interesting insight into the music people enjoy. During the big band era, performances such as the King Cole Trio were popular around the state and in the valley. Cottonwoods during the 1940s underwent a series of changes. The types of music featured were changing from African-American bands and the jazz music of the late 30s and 40s into an area where people became attracted to larger bands, the beginnings of country music as well. The dance place was more than just a place to dance. It was an escape from the war and a place where soldiers could come and see ladies perform. Cottonwoods was not a stagnant dance hall, and the owner, Gladys Wiley, was capable of running the dance hall alone following her divorce, as seen in its growing popularity and the patronage that she received from people that came to her facility. One could argue that the 1940s and 1950s represented the heyday of the Cottonwoods.
If you got the money, honey, I've got the time.
Entertainment in the 1950s continued with big bands and a gradual focus on country music. This was followed by the development of rock and roll in the late 1950s. Country bands were well represented at the dance hall by the likes of Bob Wills, the Sons of the Pioneers, Tennessee Ernie Ford, Lefty Frizzell, Hank Snow, and many others. Arky and the Jolly Cowboys was a house band during this time and quite popular. The leader of this band, Byron Julius Benedict, aka Arky, grew up in Arkansas and moved to Portland with his family as an adult, where he organized his band, which featured 14 members. Later, they became the first house band to perform at the Division Street Chorale in Portland. Following his semi-retirement in 1948, he bought the Jolly Motel in Albany and eventually relocated to a ranch outside of Salem. He showed people of the community that their neighbors were also performers, and many in the community showed up to express their support. Another popular house band throughout the 1950s was Tommy Kitsaya and the West Coast Ramblers. Tommy was a janitor at South Salem High School by day and a talented performer by night. These localized bands were known as being more than just singers. They were the people who lived in their communities and lived dual lives. Arky was a semi-retired hotel owner. Kitsaya was a janitor. The people who made a name for themselves at Cottonwoods oftentimes were people who lived in the area's local communities and wanted a fun activity that worked with their passion for music. Bands like the Jolly Cowboys and the West Coast Ramblers often played live on local radio programs of the day and then played at Cottonwoods the same night so people could go see them in person. On the radio, the disc jockey would close the show by saying, "If you like what you hear, come out to the Cottonwoods tonight." Other bands that played at Cottonwoods included the Maddox Brothers and Rose, a country group of Rose Maddox and her brothers. They toured the dance halls of the West Coast constantly and were a big draw at Cottonwoods, playing about once a month throughout the 1950s. The Maddox Brothers and Rose have a very colorful past. They struggled during the Great Depression, and as a means of finding money for their families to survive on, they tapped into their musical talents to create a band. using the daughter, Rose, as the main vocalist and her brothers playing instruments. When her brothers were drafted into the Second World War, the band halted for a few years, but picked up again in 1946 when they returned safely. The band was advertised as the most colorful hillbilly band in America, as they were known for their lively and often comical performances. They were very big on the West Coast, but never quite made the national scene, even though they performed at the Grand Ole Opry in the 1950s. Other groups during this time included Tex Ritter, a country music singer and movie actor. His concert would have brought in a large and diverse audience, both those interested in his singing and others in his emerging career as an actor. According to David Decker, between 1936 and 1945, Tex Ritter appeared in over 60 cowboy films and was a bona fide star, gaining quite a group of supporters throughout the country, including in the Albany-Lebanon area. These types of stars became a major focal point of what people wanted to see from Cottonwoods. Heck, Harper and his Wagon Masters performed at the Cottonwoods on June 13, 1958. From 1953 to 56, Heck Harper hosted the Bar 27 Chorale, a children's TV show on KPTV in Portland, where he sang and told stories from the Old West. He had a radio show on KGW and worked with several big Western bands, including the Skinny Ennis Orchestra, Tex Williams, Spade Cooley, and the Sons of the Pioneers. At his Cottonwoods appearance, children under 12 were let in free to see their hero. The late 1950s showed the increasing popularity of early rock and roll musicians, such as Fats Domino, Little Richard, Chuck Berry, Gene Vincent, Jerry Lee Lewis, Carl Perkins, Bobby Darin, Duane Eddy, Johnny Cash, The Drifters, and The Coasters all performed at the Cottonwoods, just outside of Lebanon, Oregon. A reminder. Throughout this time, Cottonwoods also remained a venue for many Pacific Northwest bands, including Clayton Watson and his Silhouettes, the Teen Kings, and the Checkers. Johnny Cash appeared at the Cottonwoods on June 26, 1959 with his Tennessee Trio. He was 27 years old at the time and had a big hit with I Walk the Line. People from the Willamette Valley were able to see this international country star early in his legendary career. One person Creighton interviewed remembered going to the show and actually meeting Cash. As the story goes, after the show, his fellow and a couple of his friends hung around with Cash on the front porch of the Cottonwoods, talking and drinking beer late into the night. He described Cash as just a guy far from home who seemed to enjoy visiting with people. Many people who remembered going to the Cottonwoods remember meeting and sometimes even dancing with the performers who played there. Fats Domino performed at Cottonwoods three times and each time brought in a large crowd. Advertisements show that these concerts were on weeknights, and as his biography states, Fats performed in both Klamath Falls and Portland, making the Cottonwoods a place he could earn extra money while traveling in between these other venues. Jerry Lee Lewis played Cottonwoods on July 24, 1958, in the wake of a scandal that almost ruined his career. Earlier in the year, he had married his 13-year-old second cousin, resulting in a loss of support for his music. Almost overnight, he went from charging $10,000 a night to about $250 in an endless succession of small dance halls. Known as the Killer, Jerry Lee gave his usual frenzied performance as he pounded mercilessly on the piano, kicked the stool across the stage, and even played it with his feet. As he walked off stage, Gladys Wiley was there waiting for him, not amused by these acts. Gladys did not hesitate to express her anger for beating up the house piano, though it's likely Lewis did not care. The glory days of the Cottonwoods Ballroom ended abruptly at the end of 1960, when Gladys Wiley closed the doors to help a family member cope with some health problems. Cottonwoods reopened under new management and featured Tommy Kazaya as the house band, but it only stayed open about a year longer. The dance hall was leased by the Big Western Music Club in 1967, who hosted local bands and dances, and for a while the building housed the Cottonwoods Trading Post, the big dance floor being used to show items for sale. In 1978, it was reopened as the Old Cottonwoods, with the great dignity of being a disco. Eventually, the building was used as a bingo parlor until 1995, when part of the roof collapsed and the building had to be torn down. The history of the Cottonwoods Ballroom was seemingly lost and mostly forgotten until 2003, when Jim Creighton began his research out of curiosity. Before television dominated entertainment, people listened to music on the radio and saw their favorite performers in person, while dancing and socializing. In time, the dance halls succumbed to changing tastes. TV brought entertainment into homes, and live shows increasingly became large concerts, and venues became bigger. For many people of the mid-Willamette Valley, the Cottonwoods Ballroom and other dance halls like it provided excellent entertainment with personal experiences and the opportunity to see and even meet legendary performers. The experiences of people who went to Cottonwoods and to other places like it across the country make up a large part of American social history, which is at the heart of a community. This was an article written in 2012 for the Willamette Heritage Center's biannual publication, Willamette Valley Voices, and was authored by local historians Tony Rush and Jim Creighton. The original article, with citations and footnotes, along with tons of engaging content and resources about Willamette Valley history, is available at willametteheritage.org/publications.
It was another week with multiple protests in front of the Benton County Courthouse in downtown Corvallis. One took place on Saturday, with between 300 and 400 people in attendance, and on Tuesday, the protest crowd was of similar magnitude. Signs read, "Deport Musk, the illegal immigrant." Another one said, "Change Donnie's diaper." Also signs that said, "Peace on Earth," "Close Doge," "Protect Human Rights," could all be seen. A sign I saw on Saturday said, "The orange turd doesn't respect women." Another read, "It's so bad, even the introverts are here." Public figures were on hand at the Saturday event. Known local musicians like Carl Smiley sang with a guitar and microphone alongside musician accompaniment. The town's mayor could be seen sitting in a chair at the edge of the lawn near the jail as people stood nearby singing protest songs. Protesters lined both sides of the street. I was able to speak with a few on Tuesday.
In the last week, it has been the talk with Zelensky, Trump, and J.D. Vance, where J.D. Vance and Trump were basically talking over him and not even listening and not even promoting the freedom for them as well. And that upsets me quite a bit. I don't care for that kind of activity in our country.
Could I say that I'm 87 years old? I have never been angry. I have never been ashamed as I was with the president and vice president and how they were bullying Zelensky. I am totally disgusted, and I detest Trump. I detest Vance. I detest Musk. I detest his whole cabinet. And I detest the GOP congressman who won't get off their rear ends and stop licking his boots and get on with saving democracy.
For the coming weeks, as national chaos ensues, as the daily shock of the news and unprecedented executive actions, alongside outrageous statements and unilateral dismembering of vital government agencies continue, the people will continue to rise up in actions such as protest in front of the Benton County Courthouse and beyond. The president last week declared he would shut down federal funding for university campuses that allow what he deemed illegal protests. In a country that is looking less familiar by the day, some wonder how long until these gatherings, traditionally protected by the First Amendment, will continue to be considered lawful by the governing authorities. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Dan Kroll.
The following is a message from Greenbelt Land Trust, titled Speak Up for Public Lands. Greenbelt Land Trust is a local land conservation nonprofit focused on protecting ecologically, agriculturally, and historically significant lands in the Mid-Willamette Valley. Greenbelt Land Trust works closely with many public land agencies and the people who manage our public lands, and we have especially close working relationships with the staff of the United States Fish and Wildlife Service. The scientists and land managers who work to save endangered species and imperiled habitats, and who protect and maintain national wildlife refuges like Finley, Basket Slough, and Ankeny. The Trump administration's mass firing of civil servants who care for our public lands will have destructive and lasting impacts on national wildlife refuges, parks, and forests. Important habitat work will be stopped, trails and campgrounds will go unmaintained, and the public will lose access to recreation and education. The damage to communities, economies, and ecosystems has already begun. Greenbelt Land Trust stands in solidarity with the stewards of our public lands, and we urge everyone who loves these special places to let your voice be heard and contact your elected representatives. Our work to conserve endangered species and the habitats they depend on is at risk without support of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Please join us in demanding better for land, for water, for wildlife, and for the future. This was a message from Greenbelt Land Trust, a local land conservation nonprofit focused on protecting ecologically, agriculturally, and historic significant lands in the Mid-Willamette Valley. You can find more information about them at greenbeltlandtrust.org.
This is KORC News, Music, and Civics. This is Dan Kroll, and I am at the Art Center in Corvallis. I'm joined by Jenny. And I understand that there is some spring break activity coming up for the kiddos here at the Art Center.
Yeah, we're offering our Spring Arts Adventures over spring break at the end of March. And this year we're offering two classes. We're offering Adventures in Comics with Jen Hernandez. And that class will be held at the Corvallis Museum. And we're also holding a Intro to Darkroom Photography class that will be held at Light Writer Studios with Koa Tom.
Tell me about Adventures in Comics. I guess it's geared toward grades 4 through 8.
Right. The class for the younger kids this year. And Jen helps them create their own comic characters and comic strips in zine and digital comic form.
Cool. What else is going on with the Intro to Darkroom?
So Intro to Darkroom Photography is for older kids. We're offering that for grades 8 through 12. And it'll be at Light Writer Studios, which has a full darkroom. Students will be given a camera that they can borrow, and they'll shoot a roll of 35 millimeter film. They'll learn how to develop that, and then Co will help them scan it so that they can potentially make prints and have those analog pictures on their phone at the end of the day. So yeah.
Or something they can actually hang on the wall.
Yeah.
Or frame.
Yeah, the physicality of darkroom photography is so fun. So I'm a photographer myself, and that's where I started, in the darkroom. And I don't think kids these days have had that same experience, because they're walking around with a camera on their phone all the time. So this is a really unique experience to see how analog photography works and see the magic in the darkroom.
Absolutely. And what are the dates on these programs?
The classes will be offered over spring break, which is March 24th through 28th, 2025.
A good way to keep the kids busy. Keep them out of trouble.
Yeah, and keep them creative. That's the main goal there.
And there's more information, I assume, at your website?
Yes, you can sign up for the classes on our website and read more information there about each of the courses. Our website is theartcenter.net, and the program is called Spring Arts Adventures.
All right. Well, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
This is KORC News, Music, and Civics.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. The following article was published by the Associated Press on March 6, 2025, and is authored by Martha Belisle. Headline reads, "Car being pulled from Columbia River might have belonged to Oregon family that vanished in 1958. Authorities will try again Friday to pull a station wagon from the Columbia River that's believed to belong to an Oregon family of five who disappeared nearly 70 years ago while they were out searching for Christmas greenery. The search for the Martin family was a national news story at the time and led some to speculate about the possibility of foul play, with a $1,000 reward offered for information about their whereabouts. Salvage efforts were called off just after dark on Thursday, and authorities said they could not provide a timetable for the removal of the car. The station wagon, thought to belong to Ken and Barbara Martin, was found last fall by Archer Mayo, a diver who had been looking for it for 7 years, said Mayo's representative Ian Costello. Mayo pinpointed the likely location and dove several times before finding the car upside down, about 50 feet deep, covered in mud, salmon guts, silt, and mussel shells, said Costello, who announced the find on Wednesday. "This is a very big development in a case that's been on the back of Portland's mind for 66 years, said Costello. Mayo found other cars nearby, which will need to come out before the station wagon can be pulled from the river, Costello said. Pete Hughes, a Hood River County Sheriff's deputy, said one car had been previously identified and the second was an unknown Volkswagen. We don't know what we will find, Hughes said, when asked if officials thought bodies were inside the cars. The Martins took their daughters Barbara, 14, Virginia, 13, and Sue, age 11, on a ride to the mountains on December 7, 1958, to collect Christmas greenery, according to AP stories from the time. They never returned. Officials narrowed their search for the family after learning that Ken Martin had used a credit card to buy gas at a station near Cascade Locks. Police have speculated that Martin's red and white station wagon might have been plunged into an isolated canyon or river. The credit card purchase was the only thing to pinpoint the family's movements. 5 months after their disappearance, the body of the youngest daughter was found bobbing in a Columbia River slough. The body of Susan apparently floated free of the wreckage in the spring current and was washed to a backwater slough near Camas, Washington. Virginia Martin's body was found the next day, about 25 miles upstream from where her sister's was located. The other family members were never found, but the search continued. The Martins had a 28-year-old son, Don, who was a Marine veteran and graduate student at Columbia University in New York at the time. He believed his family was dead. "It's been a high public interest case," he told the AP last Thursday. After Mayo provided part of the license plate number and other vehicle identifiers, the Sheriff's Office and the Columbia Gorge Major Crimes Team, along with the Oregon State Crime Lab, arranged to have the car pulled out, he said. We're not 100% sure it's the car, he said. It's mostly encased in mud and debris, so we don't know what to expect when we pull it out of the water. Mayo runs a business that finds things that were lost in the river, like watches and rings, but also helps with the recovery of drowning victims, Costello said. He had been looking for a research vessel that sank in 2017 when he learned about the Martin family. Mayo began digging up material on the family and used modeling to pinpoint the possible location, he said. There's a road near where the cars were found underwater. Authorities haven't said whether they think they might find the remains of other missing people in any other vehicles being pulled from the river. That was a story published on March 6, 2025 by the Associated Press and authored by Martha Belisle. And you're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics.
On Tuesday, March 4th, the Corvallis High School 9th grade boys basketball team played their last game of the season and beat out the McKay Scots from Salem with a final score of 55-30. It was an encouraging end to a season that was filled with a mix of victories and defeats for these young men, the 9th grade Corvallis Spartans. Tuesday's game was played at home on the second level gym at Corvallis High School, with the girls' basketball team playing their game in the adjacent gym downstairs. The crowd watched as the boys' 9th grade Spartans gave McKay a run for their money, though no money was known or believed to be a factor in the game or its outcome. In other words, the Spartans kicked the butt of the McKay Scots. A father of the visiting team began the game with excitement and vigor, but by the second and third period, he had become lost in a game of Candy Crush on his phone. And for good reason. While the Scots had a competitive edge and occasional promise, it became clear that the Spartans would keep a healthy lead throughout the game and eventually be the victors. A boy next to me chewed on a piece of cheese. In the corner of the gym, some wayward youth had assembled and climbed atop some rolled-up wrestling mats and began bopping one another on the head. One youth continued to hide inside the rubber mat, and I recognized him as a boy I remember as a childhood friend of my son, John, who was playing in today's game. I almost went over to ask,
"Are you being a good boy?"
just to embarrass him in front of his friends. But the excitement of the basketball game in front of me was too much. Back on the court, the Spartans continued to wipe the floor with the McKay Scots, and in the adjacent gym, excitement could be heard as the music played. During halftime, I was able to slip into the adjacent gym and get a quick recording of the Corvallis High School band playing their rendition of Holiday. That was the CHS Band, recorded on Tuesday, March 4th, in the CHS Downstairs Gym at the girls' basketball game. Meanwhile, back in the upstairs gym, the ninth grade boys' Spartans continued to put the McKay Scots through the ringer. My son John had a chance to play during the game and offered some impressive passes, some blocking, turning me into enthusiastic sports dad once again.
All right, John!
The game ended with a few three-point shots and other insults to injury as the game wrapped up with a final score of 55-30, the Corvallis Spartans winning the day. Boys spring sports started this past Monday, offering these young athletes a chance to play baseball, golf, tennis, or track. Signups for sports for high schoolers in the coming academic year begin around August. There's more information on CHS Athletics, including registration and required forms for students, at chs.csd509j.net/athletics. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Dan Krall.